is co-discovery. Hello, welcome to this episode of Core Discovery with me, Abigail Acton. What can distant planets and their satellite moons tell us about the origins of life on Earth? Are there lunar sources of oxygen that could make the moon a gateway to our solar system? New and emerging technologies are opening up an exciting era in space exploration. NASA hopes that its forthcoming Artemis mission will enable the establishment of a base camp on the moon that can support 2 to 3 month expeditions and help prepare the way for manned missions to Mars. And beyond the moon, can we look to Titan to better understand our own origins? And how can we build on what we know about the Earth's geology to better understand Mars and other planets? So many questions. Good job we have three leading space researchers who have been funded under the EU's Horizon 2020 program to share their exciting results and hopefully provide some answers. Welcome to Jeremy Gonset, who is responsible for the Technologies, Applications and Research Division at Space Applications Services in Belgium. Jeremy leads R&D activities focusing on on-orbit servicing robotics and robotic technologies for space exploration. He's the coordinator of the Love Me X project. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello, everyone.
Nathalie Carrasco, professor in planetary science at the University of Paris-Saclay, is interested in the chemistry occurring in planetary atmospheres and how it might contribute to the emergence of life. She is the principal investigator of the PrimChem project. Hi, Nathalie.
Hello, everyone.
And Stephanie Werner, the principal investigator of the PTEL project, is the professor of geophysics and planetary science at the University of Oslo. She is interested in planet formation and the evolution of their surfaces and interiors.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you all for being here. Jeremy, the Love Me X project can really be seen as having two objectives: designing a rover that can transport and operate scientific instruments in what I find the very romantically named permanently shadowed region, and the development of those instruments themselves. Where is the permanently shadowed region and what do we know about it?
Well, in fact, it's not just one such permanently shadowed region, but a number of smaller ones. And these are actually areas that are never exposed to direct sunlight, and therefore they are not contaminated by sun radiations. So this makes it like very interesting locations for scientists, for exploration. And they are very challenging to access, actually, often in craters that are difficult to reach and extremely cold. So it's very challenging for the instruments and for the rover to get there.
So in fact, it's permanently shadowed regions rather than region.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because I was seeing some great expanse, but in fact, okay, I see. So basically, yeah, it's the parts that are shadowed. So deeper craters and so on. I see what you mean. So can you give us an idea of what sort of sensors are being developed and why?
Yes. So in LoveMeX, we are developing different scientific instruments and they are being worked out by the different partners of our consortium. We have, for instance, a volatile sampler, which is actually a drilling system that can go to about 20 centimeters deep, coupled to a compact mass spectrometer, which is a device that allows analyzing the chemicals which are contained in the volatile, so really the chemicals that can like evaporate rather easily. We have also an instrument called the LIBS, which is a laser-induced spectroscopy instrument, which basically consists in a device that can, let's say, zap rocks at some distance with a laser beam and analyze remotely the chemicals in the gases which are released.
And what are you hoping to find? I mean, I can see that these sensors are fascinating and will give us more data.
Yeah, well, we are primarily focused on water ice detection. This is really one of the key aspects we're interested in. It has really some scientific interest primarily, but it may really also help, say, with applicative topics, applications in the future, because from water we can extract oxygen, which is really key for first of all, for a sustained human presence, assuming this is something we may achieve in the future, but also for spacecraft propulsion, because when you have oxygen and you can bring hydrogen, it's really the key components for spacecraft propulsion, and it could make really easier space transportation to Mars or to other planets in the solar system in the next decades.
So the idea of the moon being a stepping stone, that's partly what the Artemis program is hoping to achieve by NASA.
Yeah, absolutely correct. There are also initiatives in the US going in that direction to investigate and characterize those volatiles and water prisons indeed.
Fascinating. Okay, so how are you actually testing these instruments and what challenges are you coming across? Because I can imagine there's problems, not least, as you say, the constantly dark, hard to access, but also no gravity.
Yeah, yes, correct. So for the instrument themselves, the tests carried out by the partners are essentially indeed verifying, figuring out how they perform in conditions which are quite similar to what someone may find on the moon, which is quite complicated to reproduce on Earth. It's with special test facilities, which are vacuum chambers and extremely low temperatures within. And the challenge there typically is to reproduce a soil simulant, which is really quite close to these renal regolith that you can find like on the south pole of the moon. It's very tricky to get something accurate because nobody has been there yet. So it's based on a number of observations made by scientists so far and a number of assumptions because simply nobody really knows actually how it is like.
Mm. And the challenges that are being thrown up, you mentioned a consortium. Where are the various people based that are actually trying to tackle and solve these problems?
Right. So we have several universities involved. I mentioned the Open University in the UK and the Technology University of Munich, for instance, working on such aspects. We have a total of 7 partners in the consortium with, say, most of them working on instruments. And my company, Space Application Service, is working on the rover platform itself, which is also another challenge in terms of tests.
And what's one of the key problems that you found with the rover itself, actually having a vehicle that can get to these places?
Yeah, what is also tricky to do with the rover, to say the way to test it would require to have also quite similar conditions, but gravity there is a real concern. On the moon, you have about one-sixth of the Earth's gravity, and this is something which is tricky to reproduce. So we may also have to deal with limited, representativity of the environment where we bring the rover, and we have to deal with that and still manage to progress and prepare the platform for a potential future mission.
Uh-huh. And talking about that, that's where I was going to go to next then. If the tests do go well or the aspects that do perform well, when do you think they could actually be used? When did they come out of simulated environments and go into the real thing?
Yeah, well, we really hope indeed that we'll be in good position after this series of tests to move to the next stage, which basically means getting even further in the maturation process of the rover platform itself and the instrumentation with space-grade components that will make it really ready for a real mission that could hopefully take place perhaps between 2025 and 2030 and hopefully closer to 2025.
That's exciting. Do we have any questions? Do either you, Natalie, or Stephanie have any questions for Jeremy? Natalie?
You were talking about the challenge of for the vehicle of the low gravity, but is there also some difficulties, for example, with the dust, with the surface itself?
Yeah, that's indeed a major concern. It's quite difficult to reproduce the dust composition or the soil composition, and it's a major challenge on the moon. The dust is extremely abrasive and really, really damaging any pieces of hardware. So this is definitely something to pay attention at, but really difficult to reproduce accurately on Earth as well. Absolutely.
Mm, good question, Natalie. Does anyone have any other questions for Jeremy?
Yes, I have a second question, please.
Yes, Natalie.
So you were, of course, talking about the importance of water as a volatile to be detected, but are there some other interesting volatiles that you are looking for?
Well, it remains the primary one, to be honest, but our partners are interested indeed in identifying other traces of volatiles, although I may not necessarily be able to tell you exactly what are the other chemicals which are really of high interest for our colleagues. Yes, there are other areas of interest besides water. Water is a key one, but not the only one.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Natalie, to you now, actually. The PrimChem project focused its attention on the atmosphere around Titan, Saturn's largest satellite. Why did you choose Titan? Why was Titan of interest?
Oh, I studied Titan because it is a unique object in the solar system, of course. So what makes it really special, it is that it has a thick atmosphere with a pressure almost equal to the one we have on Earth today. And like Earth, this atmosphere is mainly made of molecular nitrogen. But contrarily to the Earth today, it is deprived in oxygen. So actually, Titan informs us on the possible atmospheric chemistry that was at stake on Earth before the emergence of life. So you probably know the primitive soup theory, I suppose. So with the atmosphere of Titan, we are able to test this theory. So the theory actually is to investigate if the atmosphere could provide prebiotic building blocks for the emergence of life on Earth about somewhere 4 billion years ago from now. And with Titan, we are able to observe the best observable analog in the solar system today to study this hypothesis in real.
I mean, and when you say study this hypothesis in real, how do you go about replicating the characteristics of Titan's atmosphere in a laboratory?
Oh, in the laboratory, I replicate Titan because it's really difficult to study it in situ.
Actually, of course, but how do you do it?
So I do it by developing an experimental platform that mimics the effect of the extreme UV radiation of the sun when it reached the highest part of Titan's atmosphere. So the principle of this experiment is quite simple. First, we flow a gas mixture at low pressure, which is consistent with the main composition of Titan atmosphere. And those are nitrogen and methane molecules. We introduce them in a stainless steel reactor. And then we expose this gas mixture to photons and electrons representative of the harsh radiations that reach the top of Titan's atmosphere. These harsh radiations are able to dissociate and even ionize nitrogen and methane.
When you say dissociate, what do you mean by that?
It breaks the bonds composing molecular nitrogen. Nitrogen is N2, so it is able to break the triple bond between the two nitrogen atoms. And methane, the chemical composition is one carbon and four hydrogen. These radiations are also able to dissociate, to break these bonds and even detach electrons and produce ionized species. So this leads to a very efficient chemical network, actually. The new reactive species react with each other and grow. And
when you say species, we tend to think of species of birds and so on. So hang on a second. So these newly reactive elements, really.
Ah, you're right. You're a species in our chemical jargon.
But yeah, so what do you mean?
Yeah, of course. For us, it means not only neutral and stable molecules, but also ions and radical, so very reactive species, everything that is a specific chemical structure.
So we're really thinking molecules, essentially.
Not only molecules, because molecules, for me, for a chemist, it means a stable one.
Oh, and, I see. Okay. Yeah. So you're thinking of molecules, beyond molecules, beyond things that are stable, as you just said, the reactive and so on.
Exactly.
Okay.
So all these chemical species.
You can use the word now, we're clear that we don't mean parrots and sparrows.
So they react with each other and grow, they attach together and condense, and they are, with our experiment, we are able to produce analogs of the haze, the chemical haze that surrounds Titan, and which is observed there. And these analogs, we have named them Titan's tholins. And thanks to the lab experiment and the high performances of the diagnosis available in the lab, we are able to hack the composition of Titan tholins and provide Earth-based answers to Titan faraway chemistry.
Now, when you say hack, what do you mean by that?
Actually, to decipher the chemistry,
okay.
To really understand how the molecules and ions attach together
and interact.
This extremely complex chemical haze.
And this haze that you've managed to reproduce and the characteristics that you've observed with regards to how things break and fragment and recombine, does this lead you to some theories, some ideas with regards to early life on Earth?
Actually, it is directly connected to this question of emergence of life on Earth. We have shown that at high altitude in Titan atmosphere, nitrogen, the molecular nitrogen, becomes a central for atmospheric chemistry. We have shown that it strongly participates to the organic growth, and that all the large molecules that are produced through Titan chemistry, they often contain more than one nitrogen atoms per molecule, so it is very nitrogen rich. This is very important for nitrogen prebiotic chemistry. For example, it leads to the formation of adenine, which is a basis composing our DNA, for example. And we have also shown that this nitrogen-rich haze continues to evolve during its descent in Titan atmosphere. And this provides an incredibly rich organic potential to Titan's surface.
Let me stop you just there, because we've been talking about the higher levels of the atmosphere of Titan. How can you assess, how can you work out that, in fact, this is descending lower through the atmosphere and finally arriving on the surface in the state that it is? What instrumentation allows you to realize that?
So we know that the aerosol, we spend something like 1 year in the atmosphere, descending through gravity toward the surface, and they grow and evolve. And they will evolve through, in particular, the interaction again with the solar radiation. And we were also able to mimic the interaction between the analogs of Titan haze and the solar radiation. And we found that this led to further chemical evolution. So the aerosol, when they reach the surface of Titan, they will be extremely complex, but still nitrogen-rich and involving prebiotic molecules.
That's absolutely fascinating, Natalie. So the principal finding that you've come away with is this, or did you build on this to come up with one other conclusion?
So actually, now I first developed this experiment to contribute to understand the recent data obtained by the Cassini space mission, because with this space mission, the instrumentation had not the capacity to really understand these complex molecules. It remained out of reach. So thanks to the experiment, we were able to further interpret the data. But now we are also working to contribute to prepare the next mission towards Titan, which is the Dragonfly space mission. And this one will actually study the surface of Titan. So now it's very important to study how this haze will interact with the surface, with the radiation, but also with the liquid surface, with the ethane and methane lakes that have been found at the surface of Titan to prepare this future mission.
Well, it sounds really fabulous. I mean, I've always been fascinated. I know very, very little about your areas of research, but space exploration has always really fascinated me. So you're really hoping that what you've established in the laboratory will be borne out by the sensors on Dragonfly. And this is where you get to find out whether theory matches reality. And when will the Dragonfly mission take place? When is it proposed that it will take place?
It has been selected. It will be launched in 2027. But it takes some time to reach Titan because it's in the suburbs of Saturn. So it's quite far away from here.
I love the term suburbs. The suburbs of Saturn. How cool is that? So how long would it take, more or less?
It will reach Titan's surface in 2035. And it will explore Titan's surface during 3 years, about 3 years minimum.
So 2035 is when we must all remember to keep our fingers crossed for you, Natalie. I will put that in my calendar right now. That's excellent. Very good. When you think of all the problems that you had to solve whilst conducting your research, what was the most challenging? What was the one thing that really kept you up at night and made you think, oh, how am I ever going to resolve this one?
Actually, I think that all the new answers and the new science is really coming with the new technologies, actually. In the sense that we have a lot of questions in mind, but to really explore them, we often need to develop some new research and development, new techniques to answer this question. So it's really a coupling between technology and science that works together.
So the technology exists to answer questions, but in fact, it provokes even more.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying. So it's like an endless wheel, which is just as well, because it means there's always more research to do. You're never out of business. Very good. Thank you, Natalie.
I ask one more question also?
Jeremy, please.
Thanks. So Natalie was just wondering whether you will develop in Latmos, in your lab, some instruments for the Dragonfly mission.
Yes, actually in my lab. So my work is really what I described. So to develop experimental support on Earth for space mission. But my lab is very involved in this space mission at Latmos. And colleagues of mine are developing two instruments for Dragonfly mission. One to study the electric properties of the soil, and another one to make some complex chemical analyses at the surface.
Excellent. Thank you. Any other questions for Natalie? Well, then can I turn to Stephanie? Hello, Stephanie. How are you?
Hello.
Welcome. The Planetary Terrestrial Analogues Library. project, PTEL for short, has the wonderfully practical goal of creating a database of geological features shown by a wide variety of rocks on Earth that can then be used to help profile specimens from other planets. I find this very satisfying. I don't know whether it's the side of me that likes classifying things or having things neatly sort of arranged and labeled, or whether it's the practical element that you'll have a database that will then enable people to understand characteristics of geological features and rocks in a situation that's very hard to work in. Or how are you actually thinking that this database can be used practically, and what does it contain?
So I think you have described it quite well already. So we have a rock collection, which shall be like catalog cards to interpret what the instruments measure. And these catalog cards are actually a little more complicated because we use several instruments to characterize this specific rock. And these instruments are then later on flown to Mars, for example, where we do not have all the facilities which we have on Earth to characterize. And therefore, by combining the knowledge we have collected here now with these complicated big instruments, when then they come miniaturized to space, we still can derive from this combination of information we have collected here all the details which we cannot directly measure.
I think it's wonderful. I think that's great. So basically they go with the database that allows them very, very quickly to find a comparative result from something that we've measured more almost leisurely or comfortably, at least, on Earth. Can you tell me a little bit more about where these rocks that you're analyzing where do they come from? All over Earth or any particular regions? Or
it's actually not so important where they come from. It's more important what they are made of.
Yes, the composition.
So we have focused on samples which are volcanic rocks. But these rocks are not made of minerals or as atmosphere species we have discussed before. So they have specific mineral combinations. But it's also not, again, so important which minerals in itself there are, but if they have the right proportion in the rock to derive then some of the history of the how this rock formed. And then even more complicated is that these minerals have a specific proportion of elements, so for example iron, aluminium and magnesium and calcium, and unlike Earth rocks, these rocks on Mars are more iron rich. So we have to make all these detailed combinations to find the right analog so that we then get a good
match
of all these rocks.
Yes, and a match for what you anticipate is likely to be found when there is a mission to Mars.
Exactly.
Yes.
And the big difference to previous of these libraries was that they focus specifically on minerals. But if we look at the grinded up rock in the machinery of a rover on Mars, then we actually have a full set of all these different minerals in a different combination, so that we then have to use this complexity, what we have already observed on Earth, to then think a little more which kind of rock we found, if it's a basalt or a granite in extreme. So it's then very different how they formed and what this implies for the history of Mars.
And that's exactly what I was going to ask you. So thank you for coming to that. What I was wondering was why? So we have the rock samples that we've analyzed that come from Earth. We put them into the database and we know what we're looking for a little bit because we're taking data that's coming from what's been mashed up and crunched up and pulverized by the Martian rovers, wheels and so on. So we know more about the composition of the Martian rocks, but what do we hope that will tell us?
So one thing is, of course, that when we have the rover running around there measuring the rocks, we have, of course, studied exactly that area already from spacecrafts flying around Mars, so satellite data. And at one point, we want to merge what we see from space far away and what we find on the surface in a very, very localized place. And again, for that, because the methods we use, and some have been explained already for the moon today, some of the methods can tell us about the element amount of elements of a specific type. Then we can say how they are combined so that they form a specific crystal or mineral. But then also we have color and shape and so on. But the instruments we sent there, they cannot do all this together because they are smaller and they are maybe not all there. So we use this library also to have extra knowledge when we measure with two instruments that we then can say, oh yeah, but if we would have an additional instrument, it should then look like this. So we have much more knowledge about what we measure.
It basically completes a picture, which, mm-hmm. which by definition must have some elements missing. And by elements, I mean pieces missing.
Yes.
But I understand that. But what I'm wondering is why bother? And so, I mean,
I forgot about that part.
Yeah, that's kind of important. I mean, I get the whole point about knowledge for knowledge's sake, and I'm really into that. But what are you hoping that will be revealed by these?
As Earth, Mars is a very complicated system of processes, and we talk about climate change and weather and weathering and how rocks transform from volcanic rock into sand and soil or something like this. So all these processes are chemical modification of what has been formed before and what comes out of it. So like a complicated chemical reaction chain. Just for us, it's more to be touched because we know rocks on the street. So when we measure the information in the rocks and the alteration products, then we can actually derive how thick the atmosphere was in the past on Mars, or how different things evolve in an atmosphere like Mars, which is dominated by CO2, totally different than on Earth. And by all this comparison, we can actually learn about Earth and about Mars. And what we do not understand, we try to reproduce in the lab. And I think when you look at all these examples of today, this combination is very, very useful to have experiments, measurements, observations, and so on. And only by all this together, one can get something new out of it.
Yes, as we said earlier, a more complete picture. Mm-hmm. Very good. Yeah, I can see your point totally. Do we have any questions at all for Stephanie? Jeremy, what would you like to ask?
Yeah, just a couple of questions. But from what you've mentioned, Stephanie, understood there was probably a focus on Mars primarily, but are there indeed also material in the database, or do you plan to have material about the Moon and other planets around?
We have quite a broad range of materials. We have also anorthosite, but because the specific instruments which we used will go to Mars, so we have focused on these ones. And yes, it's applicable to all the planets where there is volcanic activity and water present to alter the surface. And in this sense, it's broader. We can use it for small bodies and for Mercury maybe in the past or something.
Jeremy?
Yeah, just a quick one to finish on my side. Just wondering, basically, how can we access this database, or when we will be able to access it?
That's an excellent question, Jeremy. You see, you've got a user queuing up there already.
Yeah, that's I'm very happy about exactly this question, because the whole database will be released by end of the project, and that is in end of September this year. And the rock collection can be accessed, and also the all the measurements with the different instruments. So, and I guess some of them are very interesting to you.
Sounds good. Definitely. Yes.
We seem to have perfect timing for this. So just waiting for you for when you come back from holiday, Jeremy. You must be very, very busy at the moment, Stephanie. So we appreciate the time you're spending with us this morning. I would just check that there are any other questions that you would like to ask each other before I come to my final quick round question. How exciting.
Actually, I have one.
Yes,
too.
Natalie, go for it.
I am imagining the database. Actually, how will it be organized? What will be the key entrances? How do you classify the different rocks?
Yeah, so we have minerals as search item, and we have rock type as search item. Everything which can be described by word. We have even geography of where the samples are coming from. And also features in the spectra which are important. So it's, I think, quite a wide range of how you can search for it in it. Or, and then you can display the data specifically to check how clear or not so clear the detections are.
Yeah, actually, the idea I had in mind is that I suppose it is very related to habitability criteria. So will we be able to find some information related to habitability according to the rocks you are studying? Or
Nag, can I just stop you for a second? Habitability, you mean what by that exactly?
So habitability is the word for whether or not there can life okay. exist.
Whether it could support life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's what you also meant with habitability. You can derive yourself the amount of water which was needed to reach this weathering process status. And of course, the big trouble is that on Earth rocks, we have a lot of biological influence in the processes which occur. And therefore, these rocks are, of course, analogs in the assemblage of different minerals and elements, but they are not analogs in the sense of how they form. So therefore, it's not a direct match to say if we find this rock type or this clay mineral, then we know it was 50 millibar water in the atmosphere or something like this. So we cannot do that.
Uh-huh. Okay, that seems perfectly reasonable. So they might have the same sort of compositions, but they might not have got there the same way.
No, because yeah. we have geological processes on Earth like plate Good. Tectonics, which we do not assume for Mars, for example.
Right. Okay. Any more questions? Okay, well, then I'm going to step in with my final one to all of you. So I'm just going to ask this to all of you, and you just answer in turn. Let's project ourselves 50 years into the future, all right? How do you see that future developing, and what part will your results and findings have played? So I shall turn to Natalie first.
So actually, in the next decade, we know that humanity will probably have come back to the moon and possibly also landed for the first time on Mars. So I guess that in 50 years from now, we will have spread maybe everywhere in the solar system. And maybe we'll begin to look outside in the direction of habitable exoplanets. So actually, I hope that with my project, we will have contributed to first characterize the prebiotic resources that are available on one of the most habitable inhabitat in the solar system, which is Titan, but also to understand and predict the role of atmospheric chemistry into the emergence of life on Earth and maybe beyond in the universe.
That sounds wonderful. I say your timeline is very tight. Gosh, that sounds quite exciting, actually. I was sort of envisaging what you're talking about as being hundreds of years' time, but you're right. I mean, once these things start rolling, they roll quite quickly. Jeremy, same question to you. 50 years' time, where will we be and what will the role of your project play?
Right. So, yeah, well, with LoveMeX, well, we may expect hopefully improved understanding of the environmental conditions on the moon. Preparing a sustainable human presence, most likely, and help making use of local resources to enable a more affordable and more frequent interplanetary missions in the solar system. Just coming back also to what mentioned Natalie.
And would you like to go, Jeremy? Well, if you were able to go to the moon, would you be, let me on that spaceship?
Yeah, well, I mean, anywhere I'm fine. I would go to Mars most likely and farther, indeed Titan and other locations that would be exciting to explore, most probably in the next decades.
I have to say, I'd be an armchair traveler on that. I'd be wishing you all bon voyage and waiting for your postcards back at home. So, Stephanie, can I come to you? If we think about 50 years' time, where do you think we'll be and what role do you think your project will have played in that future?
Well, it's one of these projects which shall help to find life on Mars. So maybe we do that. Maybe we for sure know that we have to bring it ourselves there. So I think that is a time frame in 50 years from now for Mars. We also know that we have already taken 50 years to try to understand Mars. So maybe actually we are still challenging and struggling with all these things because we don't really know how life evolved and whether we do actually search in the right way for it and whether it is enough to find specific molecules, which then allow us to say that is the guarantee for forming living cells out of that. And I think this will be one of the other challenges which we still keep on thinking in 50 years.
Well,
maybe we can check more places.
Maybe we should check back in with each other in 50 years' time, or at least maybe so we say 20 and see whether your prophecies are coming about. And if we are still struggling to understand the nature of life on other planets and how it evolved here on Earth, then part of the answers will be coming through from your research, because it's all been very, very interesting what you've been doing and providing answers and also providing the next generation of questions, as is the nature of science, raising more questions than answers each time. Very good. Thank you very, very much for your time and your attention. It's been a great fun and a really good discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gail.
If you're interested in what other EU-funded projects are doing in the field of space exploration, take a look at issue 104 of the Research EU magazine, available on the Cordis website, cordis.europa.eu. The Cordis website will give you an insight into the results of projects funded by the Horizon 2020 programme. Find daily news articles and interviews with researchers working in a very broad range of domains, from the intelligence of crows to artificial intelligence. Results packs drill down deeper, gathering groups of projects by subject area, and the magazine showcases research on a different subject in each edition. Maybe you're involved in a project or would like to apply for funding. Take a look at what others are doing in your domain. So come and check out the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. Our next episode considers another frontier, philosophy and its relation to science. Observational anomalies, how do we approach them? Join me in autumn to hear what our next three guests are exploring.